Welcome. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's part-time consulting minister. If you are new here or this is one of your first times, we have a spot later on when you will be invited to introduce yourself if you want to. No pressure. We welcome you no matter where you are on this journey of life. We welcome you, no matter your gender, your sexual orientation, the color of your hair, the color of your skin, your family dynamics, you are welcome here. We encourage you to attend more than one service because the services can be very different from week to week. And in keeping with today's theme of remembering a small band of liberal women ministers whose ministry took place in what was then the frontier of this country, that means like here, the Wild West, I share with you these welcoming words written by Unitarian minister Mary Safford, who used them in her Humboldt, Iowa congregation from 1880 to 1885. When she was the minister there, our church, she wrote, welcomed all people of goodwill, regardless of religious connection, and drew no sharp lines between sacred and secular, but would try to discover God, the power that makes for righteousness in whatever learning and truth its members could find. And these women did not, by and large, define God as some supernatural being. They pretty much define God as love. I think these are fine words for us, even 140 years later. In the words of Unitarian Universalist Marianne Hackton Cotter, may this light kindle within us the warmth of compassion, the glow of love, the fire of commitment, and the light of truth. Winter Blessing, written by Unitarian Universalist minister Kathleen McTigg. The world catches our hearts through its light, splintering dance of sun on water, calm moonlight poured through branches, a spatter of stars on a clear night, and the bright eyes of those we love. But the brilliance never ends, even when the light goes out. Mystery shimmers and shines in the world, and even the darkest corners. It's there where the roots push life into soil and rock. It's in small lives lived under every stone. There in the silent pulse beneath the tree bark. It's in the depth of slow tides as they turn. There in the sky on moonless nights when muffling clouds block out the stars. It's there in the prison, the hospital, by the hospice bed. There at the graveside, in the empty house, something beating in the dark shelter of our hearts. The small shine of hope. The gilt edge of kindness. May we be granted the gift of deeper sight that we might see with or without the light. I'm counting on most of you having pretty short memories because as I bring my time with you to an end, I am rerunning some of Sandy's greatest hits. Hence, you are getting Wild Women of the West again, but it was over 5 years ago the last time. The classic Cinderella story isn't the only story in which changing the narrative often means changing the way we think, challenging our assumptions, creating new possibilities of how to live our lives. I would imagine that almost everyone of a certain age in this room who grew up with a traditional church background believed that only men could be ministers. I wanted to be a minister once, many, many, many years ago, because I loved going to church and participating in all the church activities, choir, family potluck dinners, the youth group, but there were no female ministers in my growing up Presbyterian years. There was a director of education. So I could have aspired to that, but I didn't. I wonder what impact knowing that there were several Unitarian female ministers in the 19th century would have had on my life decisions. I discovered the stories of the women who were part of something called the Prophetic Sisterhood when I was in seminary in the mid-1990s. And the more I learned about this small but powerful group of women, the more awestruck I was, the more full of wonder and amazement I became. The name Prophetic Sisterhood was coined by author Cynthia Grant Tucker in her book of that same name, The Prophetic Sisterhood, Liberal Women Ministers of the Frontier, 1880 to 1930. The Prophetic Sisterhood was also known as the Iowa Sisterhood. Their stories are miraculous. Not only their ministry stories, but the stories of how they lived their lives and what they had to overcome just to get to churches on a Sunday morning, especially in the winter. You might think that it is difficult to get out of bed and get started on the day's tasks on these bitter, bitter cold January mornings. Imagine having to do so in the days before central heating. I am inspired by their courage, determination, perseverance, by their prophetic voices. So I hope to impart some of my enthusiasm for them to you in the next few minutes. But first, let's consider that word prophet. What is a prophet? As you might suspect, one dictionary definition is one who speaks for God or a deity. Another one that won't surprise you is one who foretells future events, a predictor. But these aren't the only definitions, and certainly not the best ones for Unitarian Universalists. I like this definition. A prophet is one gifted with more than ordinary spiritual and moral insight. And such a prophet would make a declaration of something to come based on what is happening right now, not based on divine inspiration. Such a prophet would not speak for any God, but would always be paying attention to what is actually really happening in the moment. If it sounds like I am describing a Buddhist prophet, I think I am. Which leads to another good definition of what a prophet might be or do. An effective or leading spokesperson for a cause, a doctrine, or a group. A prophet is someone who is way ahead of her or his time. Why do we call this small group of women who were ministers in congregations throughout the Midwest the Prophetic Sisterhood? Because they looked at the world in which they lived. I mean, they really looked at it so that they were able to understand and absorb just how broken it was. And then they predicted how the world could be improved and what part they could play in healing the world. They knew that, they predicted that the future would be very grim for large numbers of people unless there were communities built on love and compassion. We're talking about the late 1800s here. The inner cities in this country were pathetic. Not that they've gotten much better, many of them. I mentioned a few minutes ago about how difficult life would have been physically and logistically for these women in the 1870s and into the 1900s, up until the group ceased to exist around 1930. And I can tell you about that later if you want to know why. There were a lot of reasons why they ceased to exist. So that physicality, the challenges of everyday life, that's one aspect of their lives that was plagued with challenges. Try to imagine living in those times, though, especially as a woman, in terms of the culture, the expectations of society, the rigid roles of men and women, the boxes people were put into and expected to stay in. When I was the minister in Burlington, Iowa, part of my job was to go to Keokuk, Iowa, twice a month and do a service there. If you are familiar with the geography of southeastern Iowa, you know that Illinois is right there. Often I would go to Keokuk via Nauvoo, Illinois, which meant going through Hamilton, Illinois. But I never actually stopped in Hamilton to explore and to try to find a city hall, if they had such a thing. And I regret that. I never did that. Why would I have wanted to explore Hamilton, Illinois? Because two of the most important women from this little band of female Unitarian ministers who accepted positions in the West, or what was then considered the West, right, were born and raised on farms along the Mississippi River in Hamilton, Illinois. Mary Augusta Safford and Eleanor Elizabeth Gordon, and a third woman who was part of this group, Carrie Julia Bartlett, later known as Caroline Bartlett Crane. She wasn't born in Hamilton, but she grew up there. Mary Safford, born in 1850, raised Presbyterian, so maybe that's one reason I have such an affinity for her. She loved to play preacher on the farm with her best friend, Eleanor Gordon, just 9 months younger. They used a tree stump for a pulpit. Mary's mother, Louisa, thought that Mary would outgrow this preaching game and eventually take her place in the Presbyterian church, working in the kitchen and praying from the pews. But as role models, Mary's parents said one thing and did another. Her father, Stephen, a farmer and a teacher, kept having to explain himself to the church board because he was much, much more of a free thinker than a rigid doctrinal believer of Presbyterianism, especially the concept of original sin and predestination. This is where I, too, parted ways with Presbyterians. He believed that the Bible was fallible. He believed in abolition. And he believed in Darwin's theory of evolution. Yes. In other words, he was a heretic. Always good for me to go back to the root word. Heretic means to choose, to take. A heretic is a dissenter, a nonconformist, one whose opinion is contrary to generally accepted truth or standards. We have a whole room full of heretics here, don't we? Sadly, Mary's father died when Mary was only 9 years old. Her mother was left with 6 children to raise and a farm to run. Louisa wanted Mary to be very clear about women's roles, yet she, Louisa, seemed to Mary to be as good a farm manager, if not better than, her father had ever been. And then there was Eleanor's influence on Mary. Everyone needs a friend like Eleanor. I had one. Eleanor's family was like a miniature parliament of world religions. The family included radical Unitarians, Orthodox Unitarians, a spiritualist, Baptist from all across that theological spectrum. There were ongoing debates about religion in Eleanor's home. Questioning was encouraged, which made Eleanor the bane of her Presbyterian and Baptist Sunday school teachers. Mary and Eleanor made a pledge in the mid-1870s to probably not marry and to save the world. I made that same pledge with my dear friend Karen in 9th and 10th grade. We're still working on that. Mary and Eleanor hoped to go to college, but they had no money. Mary did eventually get a bachelor's degree, but Eleanor did not. So Eleanor and Mary decided that they would study on their own, and they could achieve the equivalent of a college degree or decree. Emerson's writings greatly influenced these two women. They believed, as Emerson did, that people should use book learning to make the world better and to find the divine within themselves, and they believed that we all have the same divinity within us that Jesus had, and we do not need intermediaries to find the truth, to find the divine. Eleanor and Mary agreed with Emerson that finding the truth, capital T, on our own leads to self-reliance. And this in turn led the two of these women, many of the transcendentalists, of course, to a deep belief in human progress. Mary and Eleanor were not only free thinkers, but they were budding humanists. Eleanor Gordon and Mary Safford were also very fond of Theodore Parker, a well-known and famous Unitarian minister in the mid-1800s. Parker, he's the one who preached with a gun under, little space under the pulpit, because he was such an anti-slavery man. And occasionally a rock would fly through the window of his congregation. Gordon and Safford respected Parker a great deal because of his consistently unpopular positions on social responsibility issues, on what constituted a religious community, his belief that there should be less time spent in prayer and more in ethical action. And Parker believed in the concept, not an original belief with Parker, but of God as collective humanity. I can live with that definition of God. God as collective humanity. In their quest for higher education, Eleanor and Mary were reading Unitarian and Universalist authors, but they were also listening to Unitarian and Universalist ministers preach. For example, Oscar Clute, the Unitarian minister in Keokuk at this time. Clute convinced Mary and Eleanor that they could start their own church in Hamilton, and they did. They began planning services in the spring of 1879, 140 years ago. By the end of that year, the Sunday attendance in Hamilton was averaging over 150. Some Sundays they would have as many as 200 people. This is a really small farming community. There were church-sponsored lectures and plays in the evenings during the week. Somewhere Mary and Eleanor found the energy to offer services at a satellite church 8 miles out in the country. The incredible success of these female ministers is apparent through most of their stories. Their inability to increase membership in their congregations is fascinating and still challenging to us today. Oscar Clute was not the only man to help Safford and Gordon start that church in Hamilton, Iowa. Another minister who helped and supported the female ministers of the prophetic sisterhood during this time was Jenkin Lloyd Jones. Anybody recognize that name? He has a Wisconsin connection. He was certainly born in Wisconsin, but he's also the uncle of Frank Lloyd Wright. Jones was a very popular minister, but he was also the secretary of the, we didn't have a UUA then, we had the American Unitarian Association, the AUA. Jenkin Lloyd Jones was the secretary of the Western branch of the AUA, which means that he had a pretty important administrative position. Jones was having trouble getting male clergy to come to work in his district, which included Hamilton, Iowa, because the Eastern-trained, young, new male ministers, mostly out of Harvard, did not want to go, quote, to the border of civilization, where they were most needed during this time period. Jones's partnership with and support of the prophetic sisterhood lasted almost 50 years, from that 1880 to 1930 time period. And there were a few other men who supported these women and encouraged them. One was William Channing Gannett. You should recognize that last name. Yes, that is the family, the Gannett family. I think maybe their politics, we won't go into that. Jones, so he had these parishes that needed ministers. He asked Eleanor Gordon and Mary Safford to go to Humboldt, Iowa, where a Unitarian group of free thinkers was already building a church, so they didn't have a minister yet. And off Mary and Eleanor went, and they stayed for 5 years. They wrote about this time in their lives, how they found life to be, quote, harder than anything they had ever known. Remember, these women grew up on farms where life would have been pretty hard. Eleanor and Mary lived in an upstairs apartment with no plumbing, of course, no heating. Everything had to be carried in and out. Water and fuel in, garbage and ashes out. And there was poverty and illness to deal with often. And there was, of course, a harsh climate. Not that we would know anything about that. They worked 18-hour days. And these women, most of them lived well into their 80s, some into their 90s. So those were just some of the mundane difficulties that went along with living on the frontier. But there were also the cultural and societal difficulties. There were many Orthodox Christians who had also moved west and regarded these women as heretics, that word again. Free thinkers, Unitarians and Universalists on the frontier were often persecuted, harassed, ostracized, made fun of, and mocked at revivals. Presbyterians, Methodists, Baptists, even Calvinist Congregationalists would boycott businesses owned by so-called heretics. But Mary and Eleanor's Unity Church became the town's fastest growing attraction. Here are the words that were on the walls: freedom, fellowship, character in religion, truth for authority, not authority for truth. The Humboldt Church was so different from the Unitarian churches in the East. And it was different because intellectualism was not the most important part of the church's services and beliefs on the frontier. Intellectualism was useful, these women felt, was useless, they felt, unless and until it was integrated into current affairs and community service. Humboldt became a hub for a network of female ministers on the frontier, especially in Iowa, as well as a magnet for Unitarian and Universalist women, remember we're nowhere near merger yet, who wanted to promote free thinking and religious liberalism, but were never going to be able to do that in the East, capital E, East. And again, when I talk about the frontier, this always strikes me because I grew up in Northwest Pennsylvania. The frontier was Western Pennsylvania, Meadville, for example, and then extending to Kalamazoo, Michigan, Sioux City, Iowa, here in this area, the Dakotas. All right. The Murdoch sisters, I don't really have time to go into much about them, but they went to, Marion and Amelia went to Sioux City, Iowa. Their Universalist mother had five daughters, and she expected them all to be interested in and actively participate in the affairs of the world. Marion Murdoch was the first woman to receive a Bachelor's of Divinity from Meadville Divinity School in Meadville, Pennsylvania, 18 miles from where I grew up. She was an evangelical Unitarian lecturer, so she started this church, and at some point in time, she started exchanging pulpit with male ministers in the area, and one morning, so the story goes, a little boy was sitting out there in the pews, and a man, because Marion Murdoch exchanged with a man, was up here, and the little boy said in a very loud whisper, "Mommy, there's a man up there." If you're watching Victoria, you've heard the little boy say that only women can be ruling a country. You know, reminded me of that. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's a wonderful example of a pulpit where female ministers could come into their own. Eliza Wilkes, who had been preaching in the backwoods for years with the blessings of both the Unitarians and the Universalists, was asked by some 30 religious liberals in Sioux Falls to start a Unitarian free-thinking community there, and she did that. But her interest was in starting up new congregations, not in being the permanent minister of any of them. She asked Boston to send candidates. Boston, for those of you who are new, is where our UUA, Unitarian Universalist Association, is headquartered. But back then, that's where the American Unitarian Association was headquartered. So anyway, Eliza wanted some candidates, right, fresh out of Harvard, okay, for her Sioux Falls congregation. And she wrote that they were likable enough, but they were too academic. And they didn't seem to understand that in the West, a minister had to speak plainly and be concrete, her quote. Wilkes complained that a course at Harvard is not sufficient antidote for a lifetime in orthodoxy. You cannot plant Eastern Unitarian churches in this soil. Thus it was that in the Unitarian church in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the norm was definitely to have a female minister. These women were constantly at odds with Boston, with the accepted theological doctrines. Tension, a lot of tension. These women believed not so much in the Bible, but they believed in a very broad definition of God and of religion. And these women believed that action was better than only words. And they got very involved with the issues of the day. Think about the time frame again, 1880 to about 1930. So they were very involved with women's suffrage. They were very involved with prison reform. They were very involved in, Hull House is an example, H-U-L-L, trying to relieve some of the poverty in the tenements of the cities. There had been an economic collapse in the 1890s in the United States. Poverty was rampant. They were, in other words, amazing women. They, as I said, I think a few minutes ago, they lived to be quite old, especially for those times, but they never stopped working. They may have stopped, most of them decided that they weren't making much progress by being ministers. They weren't reaching enough people. So they went out into the world and did things they hoped would help more, but they never stopped. I guess you could say that they realized the value of letting their little light shine. Closing words were written by Unitarian Universalist minister Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. May it be so. Amen. Blessed be.